This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. In the spring of 1945, Germany and Italy surrendered to the Allied forces, and a few months later, Japan signed surrender documents on the USS Missouri, effectively ending World War II. Our guest Dominic Tierney says that marked the conclusion of about 100 years of American wars that were punctuated by a military victory. Something has changed in recent decades. Think of the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the precarious situation in Afghanistan today, and the return of fighting and the entrance of ISIS in Iraq. Those wars ended with loss, stalemate, quagmire, or have dragged on without resolution or a peace treaty. Tierney's book is titled The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. And as the country weighs options in the Middle East and negotiates with Iran and presidential candidates offer differing foreign policies, it seems like a good time to think about war and peace. Dominic Tierney is an associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He's a senior fellow with the Foreign Policy Research Institute here in Philadelphia, and he's a contributing writer to The Atlantic. And Dominic, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So when was the last time the U.S. won a war?
Well, that's a good question. It seems a long time ago. Up until 1945, as you mentioned, the U.S. won almost every major war that it fought against Mexico, Spain, Germany again in World War II, Japan, the Confederacy, of course, back in the Civil War. And then since 1945, the U.S. has really struggled. And it's really only won one war, which was the Gulf War in 1991, which was a pretty clear success. But if you look at the other major wars, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, they were all stalemates or defeats. So in terms of victory in major war since 45, the U.S. is 1-5.
Well, and one thing you say, and I just want to quote from the book, is we lose because the world is peaceful. And what we are seeing is not countries fighting each other and us getting involved in that or picking sides, but you've got groups within countries. You've got civil wars. You've got ISIS. These are the kinds of wars that we're dealing with today.
Right. That's exactly true. So what explains, I think, fundamentally why the U.S. has struggled on the battlefield is that the nature of war changed after 1945. So countries have largely stopped fighting each other.
That's good news, right?
That is the good news. In fact, this is a golden age in that sense. We don't have world wars anymore. In fact, great powers haven't fought for 60 years. This is fabulous. We should crack open the champagne. And there are all kinds of reasons for this. You can point to nuclear deterrence. You can point to the spread of democracy. You can point to globalization and trade. So countries don't fight. The bad news is that civil wars still exist. So insurgents didn't get the memo about the end of war, and neither did terrorists. So what you see today is that about 90% of wars are civil wars. Just look around the world. You see Ukraine, you see Syria, you see Iraq, you see Libya, you see Gaza, you see Yemen. They're all civil wars and insurgencies. And in this new era of warfare, the United States really struggled to adapt and struggled to achieve victory.
But are you saying that when it comes to our leadership, whether it's civilian or military, that they in many ways are still thinking about conventional warfare? When they think about war, that's the model they use. And even going back to the Iraq War, the second Iraq War, I remember supporters talking about, you know, Saddam Hussein was Hitler. This was Germany. Right. This was like the 1930s in Europe.
We're kind of still stuck a little bit in the golden age of warfare, this century of victories back in the 1840s to 1940s. And the U.S. military in particular, I think, favors this kind of conventional war model, use a lot of firepower, technology, high explosives to defeat the enemy. After all, it worked pretty well in World War II. But it doesn't work in these complex civil wars. So when the U.S. went into Vietnam, we relied on firepower. We relied on enemy body counts as the way we were going to win, and it didn't work, right? Because in civil wars, you need to win hearts and minds. And you don't win hearts and minds with firepower, right? You need a political strategy. And it was really true when we went into Iraq as well. Initially, the military didn't really adapt to the need to stabilize the country. We struggled to deal with the insurgency. We were too reliant on firepower. And it really took years before the military became more effective at counterinsurgency, more effective at dealing with this new era of war.
Well, even going back to the Iraq War, it began with this, you know, shock and awe. You could watch on television as Baghdad was being bombed, but it was really clear. I mean, we were told and sold that this would be a quick military victory. It wouldn't cost us anything. It would be over in a couple of weeks. And in many ways, it was over in a couple of weeks. But then, as Rumsfeld said, democracy is messy and all hell broke loose.
Right. So the first phase of the war was a conventional war between countries, between the United States and its allies and Iraq. So for a couple of weeks, we had the old kind of war. And the U.S. did great. Within a few weeks, we basically smashed Iraqi forces and toppled Saddam Hussein at very low cost. That is where the success story ended. The moment the war transitioned into a stabilization mission, into a nation-building mission, into a counterinsurgency, really, the United States had a tough time.
No.
We couldn't adapt. There weren't enough troops. The administration was not ready. It was not prepared. It was wildly overconfident about the ease of stabilizing this fractured country, divided in sectarian ethnic terms. And so the war unraveled into a disaster.
I remember interviewing someone who had been at the Bush White House, I think a couple of weeks before the start of the Iraq War, and said that at that point, President Bush didn't know that there were Shiites and Sunnis within this country that he was prepared and ready to invade.
Well, that's actually a pattern in war where we intervene in these far-flung locations, right, like Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. And these wars become what you might call alien wars, where we basically have no idea about the local culture, the local languages, the local traditions. We just suffer incomprehension. So just to give you one example, in 2006, there were 1,000 U.S. officials at the American embassy in Baghdad. Only 6 of the 1,000 spoke Arabic fluently. So that just gives you an idea of the United States really struggling to understand countries that are just wildly different in terms of their culture and their experience.
But why is this country such a slow learner? As you said, this goes back to the Korean War. Right. So this goes back 60 years.
Right. So the puzzle is, if war has changed and it's become these complex civil wars, why then do we intervene all over the place, right? And there are a lot of different reasons. You could look at, you know, American presidents and their personalities. You could look at George W. Bush. But you know what? There is a fundamental background force that explains this interventionism, and that is American power. The biggest thing that changed after 1945 is that the United States became the unsurpassed superpower. The U.S. bestrode the world like a colossus. Power, as it does to many countries, creates the temptation to act around the world. Suddenly, we had to ask ourselves, did we want to do what was within our power to do? And whereas in previous decades, the U.S. would never have dreamt of intervening in somewhere like Afghanistan, Iraq, or Vietnam. Suddenly, with this grand military force, with this huge economy, we suddenly decided that our security interests required us to basically run a country like South Vietnam that couldn't be further removed, really, from American values or traditional American security interests. So power, I think, is really the fundamental force.
And power represented by our vast military, our vast defense department?
In large part. You know, the U.S. spends as much on its military almost as the rest of the world put together. And it's no coincidence that in 2003, when American power was at its absolute peak, right? So its final adversary during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, had been bested, had disintegrated. The U.S. was now the only real global power. At that moment of maximum power, the United States chose to invade Iraq. Mm. And Iraq was a kind of luxury war. It is the kind of war that only an incredibly rich and powerful country would ever dream of doing. Saddam Hussein was not an immediate threat. Iraq was on the far side of the world. Our allies were divided. Only a country with such vast resources as the United States would even contemplate such a war.
I remember this goes back actually, I think, to the maybe the – yes, it is the Clinton administration when they were debating about what to do about Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was Madeleine Albright, she was Secretary of State, said to Colin Powell, who was, I think, head of the
Joint Chiefs.
Joint Chiefs. Yeah. And she said some version of, you know, what's the point of having a big military if you're not going to use it? That was her argument for the U.S. needs to get involved in this humanitarian human rights crisis in Rwanda.
Right. I remember Colin Powell said in his memoirs that when he heard that phrase, he nearly had an aneurysm. So there are voices of restraint out there, and Colin Powell was one of them. I wish he'd had the same feelings of restraint in 2003 at the time of Iraq.
I think he does too at this point.
I agree. So the Madeleine Albright example is a good one because the U.S. doesn't always act, right? And so it is interventionist, and we have waged these wars like Vietnam and Iraq that should never have happened. But there are some cases where the U.S. should have acted but failed to do so. And Rwanda, I think, stands out as one of those where a relatively small U.S. military operation probably could have saved an enormous number of lives. But I think the overall pattern is one where the U.S. has been too willing to act.
You interviewed a number of military people for this book. Would it be fair to say that military people are more reluctant to go to war than some of their civilian counterparts?
So that's a great question. I think a lot of people have this sort of knee-jerk sense that, well, if they're in the military, they must be incredibly hawkish. The opposite is nearer the truth. So when you're debating whether to go to war, the U.S. military is often very cautious, and generals can be some of the most dovish officials in Washington. And you know, if you look at an American president with a military background like Dwight Eisenhower, you might think, okay, Ike is going to be very hawkish. Interestingly, during the last 7.5 years of Ike's presidency, only one American soldier was killed in combat. So someone like Ike had seen the face of war, and he knew the costs, and that led him to be more restrained. It is also true, however, that once the U.S. military starts a campaign, once the U.S. military is in a war, then generals tend to be more hawkish. They tend to adopt a mindset which is, we need to complete the mission. We need to achieve victory. That is the culture of the U.S. military. And so in Vietnam and Afghanistan, et cetera, the U.S. military is usually pushing for more forces, usually pushing for victory. But before we start, often they're pretty wary.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Dominic Tierney is our guest on Radio Times. In fact, he was a guest on the show a couple of years ago when he wrote a book called How We Fight. He's now back with a new book, and it's called The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. We want to hear, it looks like, in fact, tweets and things are coming in already. I just took a look to my right here. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'll be reading some of that on the air. We will continue our conversation after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Dominic Tierney is our guest. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College. He's also a Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. That's here in Philadelphia. And he also is a contributing writer to The Atlantic. We have an excerpt of his book on our Facebook page. You can also check it out at The Atlantic site as well. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Could this also be an argument, your book be an argument, which is let's not go to war anymore? Since we can't seem to win them, let's just not get involved.
Well, that does seem like an easy solution. And I would agree that we need to raise the bar before using force. As I said, the U.S. has fought five major wars since 1945, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Gulf War. Two of those should never have been fought, Vietnam and Iraq. That's a high percentage. And I think one way to make sure our leaders are less hawkish less quick to seize the sword, is that before we go to war, we should think about what it would look like to try to get the country out of the war if it goes wrong. We should think through what the exit strategy would be if it goes wrong before we go to war. An analogy to that is before you have a quick fire wedding in Las Vegas, it would be good to spend some time sitting in the divorce courts, seeing the marital exit strategies. And if you think about that, it might give you pause before you go to Vegas. And in the same way, thinking about how the U.S. might get out of the war if it goes wrong could lead people to be a little warier ahead of time.
But who wants to think about that? Who wants to think about losing a war before you even start one or get involved in one?
Well, you need to. Contingency planning is really essential to this. But the problem is that when we start the war, the American president and even the American people are often wildly overconfident. So before we went into Vietnam, Americans strongly supported it.
Domino theory, right?
Right, domino theory. Before Iraq, we were very supportive. Afghanistan, you know, 9/11 had just happened. Bush had 90% approval ratings. We were very gung-ho. What we need to do is sit and think very carefully before we start about what we will do if it starts to unravel. That is a very real possibility in an era where 4 out of 5 major wars have become unwinnable. You really do need to think it through.
But isn't that, I mean, is that something that the military does? I mean, they may not broadcast. This might be happening, you know, in one of their map rooms or something where they're trying to figure out, well, what if this happens? What if that happens?
And the U.S. military is undoubtedly the finest military in the world. And there are incredibly smart people, many of whom I interviewed. And they do some contingency planning. But one of the things I found in researching the book is that the United States is not very good at preparing for the possibility of failure. Failure is a dirty word in the military, maybe in American society more generally, right? It's a very upbeat, optimistic, can-do kind of culture, which in many ways is one of the great features of the United States. But before we went into Iraq, for example, there was very little planning for the possibility of an insurgency. And so the U.S. was caught completely unawares when the Sunnis and the Shia formed militias and things began to unravel.
You talk about the sort of narrative of war, and one of the responsibilities, or perhaps even a key responsibility for a president, is to be able to, I guess, tell the story. Talk to, and there's so many different audiences, obviously. You've got the domestic and the international and everybody else.
Exactly. So I think this is one of the most fascinating parts of modern war. War itself, real war with hundreds of thousands of people, it's too complex for the human brain to possibly understand. We can't understand war. Walt Whitman said the real war and the Civil War would never get into the books, right? We can't understand war. What we can understand is a story about the war. That's how we think about war, as a story, as a narrative of Iraq, of Afghanistan, of World War II. And so presidents need to, as part of leadership, tell a story to the American people about the war. Now, this might seem like...
Is it a lie or is it a story?
This might seem like manipulation, right? This might seem like something for Don Draper rather than Dwight Eisenhower, right? A spin. And of course, presidents should not lie and need to talk in fundamentally truthful terms. But there is no alternative to telling a story to the American people. After all, in one sense, war is a contest to control the narrative. The enemy will certainly put forward a story of the war. The Taliban is putting forward a story of the war where the Americans are the evildoers. And so we either write the story or we're going to end up as the villain in a story written by the adversary. But the U.S. has historically not been very good at this storytelling optic side of it. You know, look at Barack Obama.
I was just thinking of him.
He came into power and he was sort of seen as the great storyteller, the liberal Ronald Reagan, you know, this great speechmaker. But really, he has struggled to tell an effective story about Iraq and Afghanistan, a meaningful story to Americans. Even, arguably, he struggled to tell a story of his administration to Americans.
Well, let me pick up on that because he ran in many ways saying that that Iraq was the wrong war. He has been more positive about Afghanistan, but nonetheless saying that this was a bad war, badly handled, a wrong war. And yet here we are still sort of drawn into the crisis of Iraq in that a president, he doesn't control the narrative. It's being controlled by ISIS, for instance.
Right.
And what do you say about that?
Right. Well, this is one of the tragedies of Barack Obama's administration. Here you have a president who came to power primarily because of his opposition to the Iraq war. Mm-hmm. Without Iraq, there is no Obama presidency. He wouldn't have outmaneuvered Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary in 2008. Remember, she'd voted for the Iraq war. That was the biggest reason why Obama won. And then he might well not have defeated John McCain in the general election without the Iraq war. It certainly contributed to his victory. So Iraq is central to his rise, opposition to the Iraq war, and his foreign policy has been based on not repeating Iraq. He supports the use of force if it's narrow and surgical. He wants to get allies on board, no nation building. And yet here he is. Last summer, ISIS pushed into northern Iraq, and Obama was faced by the possibility of the collapse of Iraq. And he did what I think was pretty much the last thing that he wanted to do, basically re-engaged in Iraq with the war on ISIS.
Well, just picking up on that, and we know the president has used drones, and I wonder whether, you know, war has become perhaps the strategic use of special forces to take out someone like Osama bin Laden, surgical strikes, as they're described, using drone warfare rather than sending in, you know, just, you know, the way we did World War II, that it is a more, if I can use the word surgical, even though I'm not completely comfortable with that.
Sure. So that is sort of how Obama is trying to square the circle. The lesson of Iraq is no large-scale boots on the ground, no nation building. But the United States has interests, and Barack Obama is not willing to accept the collapse of Iraq, the fall of Baghdad. And so his way out of this dilemma is to try to fashion this more surgical military operation, special forces, drone strikes, training, and try to find local allies to do the fighting. The problem is that we've seen some of the limits of this model of war in recent campaigns. For instance, in 2011, the U.S. helped overthrow Gaddafi in Libya using this surgical model. The U.S. led from behind, just airstrikes, and then no nation building. Well, what happened after Gaddafi fell? Libya has completely collapsed into anarchy. And then we also see the limits of this model in Iraq today. When you're fighting against a tough adversary like ISIS, it may not be enough.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Dominic Tierney, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. And we've been talking about some of the conflicts that we have been involved in and what changed after World War II. Let me read a couple of tweets and things. We've got a tweet. Why have we not learned to avoid wars that have been ended by someone else, like Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, instead of ourselves? That's one tweet. Tweet from Ron. U.S. not winning war because they focus on morality, civilian lives, unlike amoral forces like ISIS. So being that there are different rules of engagement. We fight one way. If you're fighting ISIS, they have no problems beheading people.
I mean, that is true. In a sense, there is a double standard, right? ISIS can do whatever it wants and fights in this barbaric way. The answer, however, is not for the U.S., of course, to embrace barbarism. In these kind of complex civil wars, you need to fight according to the rule of law. That's the only way to win hearts and minds. Just as an example, think about the Abu Ghraib scandal back in 2004, where a tiny minority of American military personnel basically abused some of the prisoners in the Abu Ghraib prison. Well, that had a hugely negative effect on Iraqi opinion. So it is true that there's a double standard, but I see no alternative other than to fighting according to the rule of law.
An email actually from someone anonymous saying war is lucrative and talking about big defense and its congressional proponents. And it is true when you look at the Defense Department, many of these contracts are in congresspeople's districts and they represent jobs and they represent income.
Absolutely. I think one of the reasons why the United States has struggled to adapt to the new era of war and is stuck in this kind of old model of conventional war, is that the military-industrial complex is always pushing Washington to spend a huge amount of money on big-ticket hardware designed for conventional war. A great example of this is the F-35 warplane. This is the most expensive defense program in history, a $1 trillion defense program, which has been beset by enormous cost overruns. And it's of very little use in a counterinsurgency. Mm. It's really designed for the kind of wars that don't happen anymore, sort of a big war against China, something like that. And the reason the F-35 has survived is that the military-industrial complex is very clever. The plane is built in all kinds of different locations. So every state gets a little piece of it, and there's an incentive for the senators to look the other way. By contrast, what we need for the U.S. military is things like language training and cultural awareness. But there is no language industrial complex.
Or not yet, anyway.
To kind of push that on the U.S. military.
You mentioned the fact that the era of countries declaring war on each other is over, and that is something to celebrate. And I, you know, in preparing the show, I just sort of had to remind myself that when you look at World War II, what, 50 to 60 million right. people died. Right. I mean, this was a war that's not as long as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but right. the amount of carnage and destruction is just, it's hard to quantify that.
I mean, it's just hard to imagine from our modern perspective the kind of apocalyptic struggles that the United States was involved in. I mean, just to pick two examples, the Civil War and World War II. In the Civil War, 750,000 Americans were killed. This is more than all the Americans who died in every other war put together. In World War II, about 25 million Russians were killed. This is just, you know, staggering, horrific brutality. So the end of those kind of wars is one of the great blessings. We do in many ways live in a wonderful age. You know, the European states used to fight each other every couple decades. Now you can picnic safely on the Franco-German border, have your brie, have your baguette, and there's no worry about the German troops marching over the border. So this is wonderful. But as the tide of conventional war receded, what we're left with are these intractable civil wars that haven't really gone anywhere, and in which the U.S. really struggles to achieve victory.
And I'm thinking about Syria. I mean, and I, you know, we think of wars, you pick one side and then you fight the other side. And in Syria, you've got Assad, who right. obviously has his legacy and his baggage. And then you have ISIS, and then you have all these various groups that are fighting in the middle there. Right. Which, whose side are you on, to quote a song?
Right. I mean, what do you do in a situation like Syria? I mean, my new favorite word is zugzwang, a chess term.
What does that mean?
What it means is move anguish. And it refers to a situation in chess where there are no good moves, and all the moves you could make actually make your situation worse. Obama in Syria, maybe even in Iraq, faces a kind of zugzwang, a kind of move anguish where there are no easy options. Perhaps the time to have intervened in Syria with some success was right at the start, but of course no one wanted to do that then. Now the war has metastasized. You have 200,000 civilians killed. The rebels have become ever more extreme. The Assad regime is completely intractable, unwilling to compromise. It's really not clear what the United States can do.
I mean, what happens under those circumstances?
Well, I mean, the hope is that we can reach a political settlement. But if you look at the major groups, you have Assad, a tyrant, really, and a brutal dictator. And remember, in 2013, when he used chemical weapons, the U.S. almost went to war against Assad. So he's no friend of the United States. At the same time, the two major rebel groups, al-Nusra is affiliated with al-Qaeda, and then you have ISIS. So we're not in a position really to back either of those groups. And so the hope, of course, is that you reach a hurting stalemate that is sufficiently bad that we make some sort of transitional arrangement. You know, years ago, we were hoping that Assad would step down. I think now the U.S. has backed away from that a little bit. Perhaps he would stay in power for some period. But it is really a problem from hell.
Well, and you say part of one, I mean, I don't know if recommendation is too strong a word, but you talk about the importance of talk.
Right.
People talking to each other.
Right. So I think the U.S. has a tough time negotiating with its enemies. That's definitely true in wartime. It's also true, interestingly, with Iran today, where the U.S. is part of a six-party group who are negotiating with Iran, and there is this deal that we're trying to reach. It's only in the United States that this deal is domestically controversial.
Oh, all the other countries?
In Britain, France, Germany, it's just seen as normal that you would negotiate with bad guys. But in America, the idea of negotiating with evil enemies is inherently controversial. I think partly because America is so powerful, we sort of think we don't need to. And partly because America is a very moralistic country, a very idealistic country, very attached to democracy and human rights and so on. And that means that negotiating with an evil regime can seem to be kind of sullying our values. But of course, in a world where the U.S. has only 5% of the world's population, you know, we can't control everything, and we do need to negotiate. And that's true in wartime, and it's also true in peacetime.
You quote Stanley McChrystal saying that we meaning the United States, should have talked with the Taliban back in 2003, in the really sort of early days of that war.
So one of the people I interviewed for the book was Stanley McChrystal, extremely thoughtful general. He ran the campaign for a year in Afghanistan, of course. He left office in unfortunate circumstances. He gave a very thoughtful analysis of the war when I spoke to him, and one of the things he said was the U.S. should have started speaking, negotiating with the Taliban back in 2003. That was the time to talk, because the Taliban was on the run, they were weak, they had fled south, and what the United States should have done is said, okay, you've lost the war, but there is a place for the Taliban and the Pashtun constituency that the Taliban represents in the new Afghanistan. There is a place if the Taliban evolves into a political party. But at the time, it's not that we thought about that option and then rejected it. Nobody thought about it. Yeah. The mood in the Bush administration, maybe even the mood in the United States more generally in 2002, 2003, was the Taliban are evil. We don't talk to them.
That's Dominic Tierney, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. So when was the last time the U.S. won a war? While nations rarely declare war on each other today, there are, as we all know, violent conflicts that are destabilizing regions of the world, threatening the civilian population. Our guest, Dominic Tierney, has thought a lot about this, and he's written a new book called The Right Way to Lose a War. In many ways, a follow-up to his previous book, How We Fight. He's associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College. And again, we have posted an excerpt of this book on our Facebook page. You can also check it out at The Atlantic, where he is a contributing writer. Looks like Keith from South Jersey to join our conversation. Hi, Keith. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty, and to you, Dominic.
Hey. Hi there.
The old expression is that war is politics by some other means. And war, to me, back to the proverbial dawn of man, was about conflict over resources. That group over there has the water. We want the water. They're not going to give it to us. We have to get it. We went to the trouble of killing the mastodon. That group raided us, took the meat. We have to go back and get it. So for the millennia, it's been about space, land, resources, and of course the minds of the population had something to do with it, but as long as the population was quiet, it would be okay. But after the Second World War, it didn't seem so much like a matter of resources. War was a matter of conflict over the mind. With the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, it wasn't enough to come into the village and everybody stay in their homes. You either had to think like them and say so, or they killed you. So I wonder if Dominic could comment on whether war has changed from conflict over resource to conflict over the human mind, and can the United States or any power win that kind of war ever again?
Keith, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Dominic.
Sure. Thank you, Keith, for that very thoughtful analysis. I mean, I think that that is absolutely true. War is politics, continuation of politics by other means, as Clausewitz famously said. And war has always been political. But I think, as Keith alluded to, more recent conflicts, these civil wars, are perhaps especially political. You know, so in World War II, you know, you can go and blast the Japanese here and push back the German forces in Normandy. But in civil wars, there aren't these clear front lines. Instead, it's fundamentally about winning the legitimacy and support of the population, winning the hearts and minds. And so these wars, these civil wars, these counterinsurgencies are inherently political, really at every level, from the decisions the president makes to a decision that an individual American soldier would make about whether to smash down a door in Iraq or knock on it. Well, if you smash it down, then you may, insult the father in the family and create more insurgents, et cetera, et cetera. Politics is just imbued at all levels. And so we need to think of war as fundamentally political. The solution to ISIS, for example, is going to be political. Mm. It's not going to be military. The solution, if we can find it, lies with the hearts and minds of the Sunni population, and somehow trying to ally with the Sunnis against ISIS. It is a political
victory. To rise
up
against, I guess, under their thumb.
Right. I mean, that back in 2007, where the surge helped turn around the war in Iraq, pull Iraq back from the brink. The key thing there, in many ways, was what was called the awakening, where basically Sunni insurgents allied with the U.S. against al-Qaeda in Iraq, and we put them on the payroll. Something similar is going to have to happen if we're going to make progress against ISIS. The key is the Sunni hearts and minds.
Well, and, you know, they're in Ramadi. I mean, it's right. Sort of like deja vu all over again. We're still trying to win the hearts and minds.
Right. And it's tragic. You know, these incredibly brave American soldiers, these veterans, turning on the news and seeing Ramadi falling to ISIS, these cities that they bled for to capture and then recapture from insurgents. And then here we are. I mean, your heart goes out to them.
You know, it's interesting. Keith talked about resource wars, and it's interesting to think about that as, you know, this horrible drought in California. Mm-hmm. You've got the potential for future fights or even current fights about resources, whether it has to do with crops or water or even land as we've got sea level rise.
Right, exactly. So the environment has always been part of warfare. Countries have always competed. One of the reasons Japan attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor was because of competition over oil. They relied on American oil, and the U.S. shut down the oil supply. So resources have always been important. But as we move into an era of environmental stress, with water shortages, with climate change, we may see resources playing an integral part. And I think they're actually likely to exacerbate this issue where civil wars have become the predominant kind of war, because they will lead to particular stress in the poorest countries. And so you're going to see internal problems, division over resources, refugee flows. You know, you see these refugees fleeing Libya today to try to get to Europe. Thousands of them are drowning. Well, add climate change to that picture, and we may see even worse refugee flows.
Keith, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of comments on our Facebook page. Also, email comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, Charlotte says, do you think that the fact that we are a Christian society colors the way we fight? What do you think of that, Dominic?
Well, that's a great observation. I think that America is a very moralistic country. Americans are deeply attached to a set of ideals. Really, in many ways, this is the founding element in American identity. I think this idealism is partly political idealism, commitment to democracy, and then it's partly religious idealism. America is far more religious than most other advanced democracies. You know, in many ways, this is the fundamental element of who Americans are. You know, if you took that away, there would be nothing left. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Russians supposedly believed in the Soviet ideology, right? But at the end of the Cold War, they sort of cast that away like a cloak. And underneath, they still had this Russian nationalist identity. But American idealism is the American identity. If you somehow cast that away, I don't know who Americans would be. You would just have a bunch of people walking around the continent. So this idealism, I think, shapes how Americans think about foreign wars. In part, for example, it creates a crusading view of war where we believe that we were on some great mission to spread democracy. We believe that, you know, if you scratch beneath a foreigner, there is an American trying to get out. And that has been a long part of the American story.
I mean, it's the exceptionalism, right? The American that somehow we are exceptional as a nation, as a group of people.
And that is, in many ways, the most wonderful thing about America. That is, in some part, what drew me to America many years ago from my original home in Britain, is this incredible positive spirit that Americans have. This anything is possible mentality, this commitment to a set of political ideals that I think have enormous value. But this idealism, this moralism can create some problems. Mm. It creates this crusading mentality. It's one reason, for example, where we have a tough time negotiating with enemies. We sometimes see the world in very black and white terms. We see, you know, Vietnam as part of the communist world, monolithic communist world in the Cold War, and we don't see the distinctions. We lump together different actors in the war on terror. We see the Taliban, Al-Qaeda is the same. They're bad guys. Bush said there was an axis of evil between, you know, North Korea and Iran and Iraq, which had nothing in common. So that idealism can create this sort of simplistic good guys, bad guys vision of the world.
And when you look at U.S. history, have we mostly been at war or some version of war? If you throw in, you know, the Cold War and some other sort of less declared wars?
Well, you know, Americans, I think Americans see themselves as a peaceful country, right? And I think that the vision is that Americans are peaceful, and then the enemy attacks us, like at Pearl Harbor, or maybe the Spanish and the Spanish-American War, or the Confederacy at Fort Sumter, and then we gear up, we defeat them, and then we sort of go back to being civilians. And there's some truth in that, but if you look particularly at recent years, America has been at war an awful lot, and you know, the Cold War in some ways was a series of endless conflicts, punctuated by two major wars in Korea and Vietnam, and of course more recently the War on Terror. You know, it's hard to see how the War on Terror is ever going to end. Which American president is going to be brave enough to declare an end to the War on Terror? They would live in terror that there would be an attack in the United States, and then they would look weak or foolish. So how does this long war, this war on terror, ever conclude?
Well, and that, which raises the question about a kind of war weariness. And one senses this desire to withdraw a bit from the world because of these intractable conflicts that we get involved in and we can't get ourselves out of, and we can't see how we might have improved something.
I think that's right. If you look at American history, we tend to go through these kind of swings between interventionism and crusading mentality and we can change the world. And then things don't work out as we had hoped oftentimes. And then we sort of have a period of reflection. We don't want to do this again. It's sort of a little bit like going out, having a lot of drinks and then being hungover the next day. Mm. But the thing is that the hangover eventually ends, right? And so America tends to swing back. And so at the moment, we're sort of in this hungover, we don't want to do this again mindset. But I think you can already see the inklings of the sort of next hawkish upswing. Most of the Republican presidential candidates, for example, have embraced a hawkish doctrine. Rand Paul is really out on his own. I think Hillary Clinton is going to run slightly more hawkish than Barack Obama. So I think the pendulum will swing by 2016 a little bit more back in that direction toward more of a kind of interventionist mindset.
You talk about something, or you describe something called ugly stability.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
So this is to do with what is our goal in war. And the most important question when you go to war, when you're in war, is to ask yourself, what are we fighting for? What is the goal? We often don't ask ourselves that question. What is the goal in the war against ISIS? I'm not even sure the administration knows. What is the
defeat them, right? Isn't it?
Well, they sort of use this language, but what specifically would that look like? And so one of the things I say is that in these difficult campaigns, oftentimes we should forget about creating a beacon of freedom. That was George W. Bush's initial hope in Iraq, a beacon of freedom in the Middle East. It's not going to happen. Instead, the goal should be ugly stability, some sort of enduring political settlement. But it's not going to look like democracy as we understand it in the United States. I mean, take a country like Afghanistan, right? This is a country where the literacy rate in Afghanistan is lower today than it was in America in 1650. Right, so you're not going to turn Afghanistan into anything that looks like the United States in a generation, maybe even a century. But what you could do is create ugly stability, some sort of deal with the Taliban, put Afghanistan on a path toward getting closer to, say, Bangladesh. And so realistic goals are essential in these kind of military operations.
Should we retire the word victory when it comes to...
Well,
conflicts
that's
or
going to be
war,
tough. That's going to be
military
tough.
Engagements.
Tough for Americans because this is a victory culture, right? General Douglas MacArthur famously said, "There is no substitute for victory." He said that at the time of Korea. And that I think a lot of Americans would nod along at that. They really feel war and victory, this is the American model. Well, what we've discovered in the last 60 years or so is there is a substitute for victory. In fact, we've lived it. And it's everything from a partial success to a kind of messy stalemate to a really tough failure like Vietnam and Iraq. So victory is possible. And, you know, if we reform the military and if we change our view of war, we can start winning wars again. And the last part of the book is about how we might actually turn things around and achieve victory. But it is tough in the modern era of war.
What would that look like?
So what I lay out in the book is a sort of a series of key pointers to surviving in the new era of war. So what I say is that we can make war safe, legal, and rare.
Like abortion, right?
Right. So safe means preparing for the kind of wars that we're actually going to face. In other words, if 90% of the wars today are civil wars, and if we almost all conflicts turn into these sort of difficult stabilization counterinsurgency missions, then the U.S. military needs to be ready for those kind of operations. Yes, you know, prepare for the big war against China, right? Yes, obviously. But that's unlikely. What is likely is a more Iraq-Afghanistan type of campaign. So prepare for those wars. That, by the way, is incredibly controversial in the U.S. military. It doesn't want to do that. For instance, a few years ago, the military set up the Irregular Warfare Center designed to actually learn lessons from Iraq and Afghanistan, entrench these lessons in the U.S. military. Well, last year, the U.S. military said it was closing the Irregular Warfare Center, even though 90% of wars are irregular wars. So prepare for war, and then legal would mean when we fight these wars, fight them according to the law, get congressional support, get domestic support, get international approval, if possible, Security Council approval, and then on the ground, fight according to the rule of law. Don't kill civilians, win hearts and minds. And then rare means raise the burden for fighting these wars. The end result would be fight fewer wars, but then win the wars we do fight.
We're almost out of time here, but this is your second book on war. Why are you so interested in war?
This is the great issue of the age, right? In many, one of them is what do we do in these difficult, intractable campaigns? And then there's a personal story. My great grandmother's first husband in World War I went off to fight in war, and he survived almost the entire war, and then he was killed just a few weeks before the end of World War I, and he sent this very poignant letter to my grandmother. It's actually the preface to the book, all about how he wanted to get home. And that story really drove home to me the human cost of war.
Well, on that note, Dominic Tierney, always a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Much to talk about and think about. The book is called The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. And again, he's associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He also was a contributing writer to The Atlantic, where an excerpt of the book is posted. Also, we posted that on our Facebook page. In fact, go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can figure out how to download a podcast clips of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We welcome Claire Moran, our summer intern who started today. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.